Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staber. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch you up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. And what a week it was. Ohio's primary election night proved Donald Trump is still kingmaker, who can catapult his candidates to primary victory. Republican businessman Bernie Moreno will face Sherrod Brown this fall, and control of the U.S. Senate hangs in the balance. The race is expected to be the biggest and probably most expensive Senate race in the country, which means last week's primary was a prelude for the advertising tsunami coming in November. Joining me to help us wrap our heads around what we're in store for over the next 7 months is Sarah Donaldson, State House reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com.
Morning. Great to be here.
And Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4.
Great to be here.
So, Natalie, we're talking great big piles of cash being dropped on television stations this fall. You talked to Republican and Democratic strategists. What did they tell you about what we're going to see between now and November?
A whole lot of money and a whole lot of ads. So it's probably going to be difficult to turn on your TV and not see some sort of political ad. I think Marino's side and Republicans have already allocated something like $89 million. Sherrod's side already allocated near $70 million. So there's going to be a whole lot of money spent. And that's just in the initial allocations, right? This is going to be a very hotly contested race. A lot of eyes from all over the country are going to be on it. What we'll likely see, according to the strategists, is they're going to play nice to start with these first few months. It's going to be ads getting their names out there, what they're going to do, what they have done. And then once we get closer to November, we'll start to see some of those attacks.
So like once kids start going back to school.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Do we have any sense of where that money might be coming from?
I'd say it's kind of a mix. I mean, Sherrod Brown's going to have a lot of people supporting him from Congress, like Schumer will be supporting him. He'll probably have a bunch of special interests putting money into this race as well. And I would say the same could be said for Marino. I mean, we know Trump endorses him. We know J.D. Vance endorses him. So also some special interest groups, some issue groups, I would guess, are likely going to be putting a lot of money into this race. Again, this race could control who, which party controls the U.S. Senate. So it's not a small deal.
And speaking of endorsements, on election night, Bernie Moreno said that he wears his Trump endorsement as a badge of honor.
Yes.
I wonder whether Sherrod Brown is going to wear with honor his 99% voting record with Joe Biden. Whether Joe Biden is the kind of person that he likes to associate with, because I would predict this. If Joe Biden enters Ohio, Sherrod Brown's going to fly out of here like a scared cat.
Jeremy, to Moreno's point, how much, if at all, do you expect Brown to distance himself from Biden during this campaign?
I think especially early on. I mean, Sherrod Brown's already airing campaign ads that don't mention really him as a Democrat. It doesn't mention him. It doesn't make any mention of Joe Biden. Sherrod Brown's going to reach out to these independent voters, the voters that backed Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020, but also helped elect Sherrod Brown back in 2018. And you're already seeing but at the same time, you need to get, you know, you kind of have to circle the square of getting those voters while getting out the Democratic base, too. So it's not a surprise that Bernie Moreno is trying to do this, because obviously Ohio has been a Donald Trump state. So if you can tie yourself to Donald Trump and win, you know, if you can get the same voter margin that Trump did, you'll win by 9 points like Trump did. This also, of course, shows that Bernie Moreno, his victory was due in large part to Donald Trump's endorsement. So it's both a reflection of his past support and also a pretty good campaign strategy going into the general.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with everything that Jeremy said. And I think it'll be interesting. I mean, I think Moreno made it pretty clear on election night that he's not going to shed Donald Trump's support in the general. I think he's, like he said, is going to still, you know, heavily feature it in advertising and speeches and all the like. I don't think it's something we're going to see like disappearing from the race.
Yeah, Moreno said something I found really surprising on election night. He told Spectrum's reporter Harry Lee that he's not worried about winning crossover voters, like independents, because Trump won Ohio. So he thinks there's enough Trump Republicans to get him over the finish line without picking up independents. And now, like, that's, I mean, right? Trump won by 8 points both times.
I can see where that logic is coming from. I think on a presidential race, though, it's a lot different than a U.S. Senate race. I mean, Sherrod Brown also sells himself as this moderate who could pick up a lot of those independent voters. And if Sherrod Brown picks up a lot of those independent voters, I don't think having the Trump Republicans alone is going to be enough. Granted, I'm no election specialist, but I just think that's a gamble to kind of alienate independent voters so soon.
Democrats were hoping for a Moreno-Brown matchup, right, Jeremy?
They were. Chuck Schumer's PAC actually put in millions of dollars before the election in a ad campaign basically saying, hey, you know, Bernie Moreno is a Trump Republican. Don't forget that, Republican voters, that he's a Trump Republican. So you should be very scared of him, Democrats. And they obviously want to see Moreno. Now, you can ask President Hillary Clinton how that worked out for her in 2016 when many Democrats wanted to see Trump as the nominee because they thought he was the, you know, best candidate against Hillary. Well, I mean, see how that worked out for them. That's kind of a cynical ploy to do that. But we'll see. We'll see if Moreno, I mean, he's not wrong. And as you've indicated, he's not wrong that if he just follows the Trump playbook, he's going to win here. He's off to a comfortable margin. And even looking at the 2022 Senate race, when Tim Ryan made inroads, but it wasn't enough to overcome that advantage that Republicans have for a statewide office in Ohio.
I just think the 2 points with this one, like differentiating between 2022 and this, obviously Tim Ryan was not the incumbent senator and Moreno is facing Sherrod Brown. And I'd argue that J.D. Vance had a little bit more name recognition than Moreno. I think Moreno probably has a little bit of name recognition by this point. He's been running, but Vance had obviously authored a pretty well-known novel and people were aware of him. So I think those are the 2 points that kind of stick out to me.
I want to play a clip from Senator Brown when he was on MSNBC on election night, reacting to facing Moreno in the fall.
Bernie Moreno always looks out for himself. I mean, he has said in this campaign that he won't work with Democrats. He just is going to go to Washington and do his own thing. He's illustrated that by again calling for a national abortion ban with no exceptions, even though Ohio overwhelmingly last November voted by 13 points. For constitutional amendment on abortion rights. And the arrogance of he doesn't really care what the voters want. That's really who he is. And we will make that contrast.
Natalie, you think that's going to be part of his strategy, even though abortion isn't on the ballot, to kind of make it about a possible vote in Congress?
I'm really curious to see how that plays out, because in 2022, we were coming off Roe v. Wade being overturned, and that was part of the strategy, but it wasn't enough for Tim Ryan. Now, here in Ohio, we've codified the right to abortion to the point of fetal viability in our state's constitution, so I think Ohioans feel kind of protected. I mean, some polling shows that abortion and reproductive rights is number 7 on the list of issues that Ohioans care most about, so I think if he's going to make that a strategy, it will really have to play into the this is imminent, this will happen kind of thing. It will be really interesting to see how much Ohioans care about it closer to the election. Right now, of course, we're seeing economy and border being two of the big ones.
So Moreno, we've been talking about him a lot in the matchup against Senator Brown, but there were two other guys who ran and lost for the Republican Senate nomination. It looked for a while like Matt Dolan, he is a state senator from Northeast Ohio. It looked for a while in the pre-election polling like he might go neck and neck, that he might be close. And in the early vote, they were like flip-flopping back and forth for front runner. But then Bernie ran away with it. What do you make of that, Jeremy?
I make of it that Donald Trump is still the kingmaker within the Republican Party, not only in Ohio, but around the country. Especially when you have a Senate race like this, where it's divided among three people. You don't just have like a pro-Trump and another candidate that can unify maybe not the anti-Trump forces, but at least not the pro-Trump forces. And so you have a Republican Party that is increasingly dominated by Donald Trump, not only because back in like 2016 when Trump was first running, the main litmus test was whether you agree with Donald Trump on issues. And now it's increasingly about showing personal loyalty and being a cheerleader. Are you sufficiently behind Trump to be the nominee for Senate? And there were questions about, I mean, Matt Dolan didn't go for Trump's endorsement, and Franklin Rose certainly did, Secretary of State, but then he didn't get it. And now Bernie Moreno had unquestionably benefited from that. And if you can see in any Bernie Moreno ad that he's very, very proud to tell you that he has Donald Trump's endorsement.
Sarah, you know, Dolan had the endorsement of two heavy hitters from the old guard of Republican politics here, Governor Mike DeWine and former Senator Rob Portman. Both of them endorsed Matt Dolan, but it didn't really seem to matter.
No, I don't think it obviously mattered at all. I mean, you know, some of the one Emerson College poll that showed Dolan pulling ahead of Moreno was actually before the DeWine endorsement. Obviously, I don't know that it really swayed him. And in talking to my colleague Karen Kassler, she was with Dolan on election night and I was with Moreno. A lot of the folks there at Moreno's party were traditional Trump supporters, MAGA hats, Trump shirts, Moreno buttons. A lot of the folks at Dolan's party were traditional establishment types, so you saw them in two very separate lanes. And clearly, I mean, even though DeWine won re-election by really strong margins 2 years ago, I mean, clearly when it comes to newer age candidates, it's this America First MAGA movement.
Natalie, so Secretary of State Frank LaRose also ran. He came in a distant third. Where does he go from here? I guess he could run for another statewide office in 26.
I guess so. I mean, wait for another Senate seat to open or congressional seat, something like that. But for now, it's finishing off his term as Secretary of State and then seeing what 2026 brings, whether he runs for office, whether he goes into the private sector. I mean, I don't think he'll really have a shortage of options between running or going to the private sector or anything like that.
Yeah.
But for now, he'll stay still as the Secretary of State.
And you make a good point. It's not a given how the outcome of the Senate race is going to go. Like, if Bernie loses to Sherrod, there'll need to be another, well, Republican to challenge him, or depending on what Brown does after this next election. So who knows?
And I think, like, in looking back on this race, it can't be understated, like, the money involved in the primary too. Obviously, Dolan and Moreno were huge self-funders. They were making serious personal contributions. And LaRose really never had that. I know he made like a $250,000 contribution at one point, but his kind of paled in comparison. So it's, I think that portion really shows how powerful. I mean, that right there is like an example about how powerful money is in politics.
Let's talk about a couple of the congressional races really quick. So Derek Marin, the almost House Speaker here in Ohio, is going to be the Republican who takes on Marcy Kaptur. He also got the endorsement of Donald Trump. But Jeremy, I'm not convinced that propelled him across the finish line because it came so very late in the game.
Right. I mean, in some cases, Trump is trying to play kingmaker. And in other cases, you know, it's sort of a win-win for Donald Trump. Either the candidate wins, and then Donald Trump can say, hey, I played kingmaker. And if the candidate loses, you know, Trump can say, well, you know, I did everything I could, and, you know, you do whatever you can. So, like you said, in this particular instance, Trump's endorsement came late, but it's also a reflection of that this has been just the most roller coaster primary in among any of Ohio's congressional races. You had J.R. Majewski, who was the nominee 2 years ago against Marcy Kaptur, the incumbent Democrat, who lost 2 years ago among some bad media reports. And then he was going to run this year, and then he didn't, and then he came back, and then he didn't. And then Craig Riedel, who initially was the establishment favorite, dared to say that he wasn't a big fan of Donald Trump, so that immediately made him persona non grata. And So then Riedel was cooked, and then Marin was a relatively late entrant into the race because all of a sudden there was sort of a vacuum among candidates. And now Marin is going to be in for a pretty big contest against Kaptur, who has managed to hold on for more than two decades. That'll be a toss-up race going into November.
Yeah, Kaptur has one of the few seats in the country where Trump won her district, but she still holds it as a Democrat. So I guess essentially I just feel bad for the people of Toledo because they're not going to be able to turn on their televisions from now until November. Like, because not only do they have the Senate race, they're going to get the Kaptur-Marin race.
Not to mention a lot of Michigan campaign ads, too.
Oh, so. The people of Michigan are going to be so confused.
Yeah.
Like the ones that are in the Ohio media market up there. I also want to quickly touch on Republican Senator Niraj Antani. So he is a state senator who was in an 11-way primary for a very conservative congressional seat. He finished 10th out of 11, I think. He is not running for a re-election in the state Senate because you can't be on the ballot twice. So what does he do now?
Well, the reason he ran for Congress is because he was one of the incumbent Republicans who had their district redrawn in redistricting last year to a big disadvantage. It became a slightly Republican district. It went from that to being a pretty leaning Democrat district. And so he said, well, hey, I'm going to run for the second congressional district. I don't live there. I live about 90 miles away, but I'm going to run anyway. This was really a real uphill battle for him because you had one, there were like more, almost a dozen candidates running in that Republican primary. It's the most Republican district in the state.
It was really the general election.
It was really the general election for this district that covers Claremont County. So basically east of Cincinnati, most of a lot of southern Ohio. And you had the top three candidates each dumped more than $1 million of their own money into the race. And Niraj Antani, who is not independently wealthy, at least not to that extent, didn't really have a chance. But then again, neither did. There was State Senator Shane Wilkin, who did have more money, and he got trounced as well. So it was really, also a sign, too, of it, especially in the Republican Party, being not having political experience has gone from being a bug to being a feature. And it's really become a good thing to campaign on, that you don't have any political experience and aren't tainted by, being a part of the swamp.
That was Jeremy Pelzer, a politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Coming up, we're looking at Ohio's state house races and how political infighting could affect whether anything gets done between now and next January. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch up on the politics news of last week and preview the week ahead. Still with us is Sarah Donaldson, State House reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. So, let's talk about the Ohio State House. Four Republicans in the House lost their seats to primary challengers last week. They were part of what is pejoratively become known as the Blue 22. That's the GOP members who worked with Democrats last year to elect Jason Stevens. Is this a big deal, Natalie, to lose four incumbents?
It was an unprecedented election. For example, Representative Bill Seitz, who has been a state representative for more than two decades now, says he has never seen an election like this where incumbents are being challenged so harshly and so vehemently. So it is a big deal. I mean, it's not small. One of the people who lost was in leadership. So you know, when you hear the number four, it doesn't sound like a whole lot, but given that they were incumbents who have been there for years, it's not small.
Yeah, the losses were Brett Hillier, John Cross, Sarah Carruthers, and Gail Pavlida. And it seems like their opponents were pretty effectively able to use their support for Stevens as a campaign issue.
I think it kind of plays into that. To win a primary, you have to be much further right than to win a general election. So I think it kind of played into the, oh, look, they worked with the Democrats. They want to be bipartisan, which really hurts, can hurt in a primary. So, yeah, working with the Democrats to elect a Speaker of a House, even though he is a Republican Speaker of the House, just not, does not go over well in things like a primary.
Yeah, the real controversy, Jeremy, seemed to be that Stevens had didn't have a majority of Republicans on his side last January.
Right. This is not about ideology. Most Ohio House candidates overall agree on the issues. This is about personal relationships, about how Stevens, the presumptive nominee for Speaker was Derek Marin, who's now going to face Marcy Kaptur, but he was chosen initially by the Republican caucus to be Speaker. But Jason Stevens employed Democratic votes, and then with only a third of House Republicans got elected Speaker. And that didn't sit well, of course, with many Republicans who thought that, you know, he made a deal with the devil or a deal with Democrats. And for many people, that's the same thing. And as a result, that's become an issue in these primaries. It was a fairly low turnout primary. So you, if you can have harness that anger and get enough voters out, you're going to lose your election. And that's what happened. I mean, this is the most, these are the most incumbents to lose their seat in the Ohio House in three decades. And so it's very notable. But then if you're looking at vote counting, I think it's it's kind of too soon. There's a lot of variables left. This wasn't the knockout blow that, because Matt Huffman, who's the outgoing Senate president, is going to try to challenge Jason Stevens to become Speaker next year. So now the focus turns into, comes whether Huffman has enough votes to win that. And you need 50 votes in the 99 seat House to win that. So there's a lot of, there's a lot left to do about whether these seats will be won by a Democrat, how, and whether the people who voted for Stevens or against Stevens last time will continue to vote for that person this time. So it remains to be seen. There's a lot left to go before we can predict a winner in that.
Yeah. And I think,
oh, go ahead.
I think between then and now, too, one of the big questions is what's going to get done? I mean, this infighting is not going to stop. It's not going to be stalled at all. So what's going to get done? Is the same legislation going to be stalled? Is legislation going to move forward? Likely the Capitol bill will get done. But for some of the other pieces of legislation, they're still being used as political weapons and weapons between chambers and leadership. And like Jeremy said, it's not really a matter of ideology, because if you sit down with any of these Republican lawmakers or any of the Republican leadership, for the most part, they'll agree on the legislation. It's just whether or not they want to support someone who doesn't support them or support someone who's going to gun for the speakership who they don't support, that sort of thing.
Yeah, this conversation we're having, while fun, is very much palace intrigue. Like, who's going to hold the gavel? Who has the votes? But Natalie's right. There is a real world impact here. And Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio had this to say.
I really hope they solve their family feud and figure out all of the barriers to getting things done so that we can get things done.
And Sarah, you know, it was kind of a mixed bag in terms of results. While the loss of four incumbents is historic, there were a number of incumbents who survived this challenge, right? Like Haraz Gambari, Kevin Miller, Jeff LaRae, Gene Schmidt. They all fended off their primary challengers.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree with the sentiments that this wasn't like a knockout for all of these challengers. And, you know, several folks survived. But I think, like Jeremy said, it's too early to tell about how this will affect the speakership race, how it, I mean, the folks who are in office now, obviously some of them have lost elections. But it'll be interesting to see how it affects the folks who did win, when they had a challenger, could they switch their vote next time around? Was this a warning sign to them? Hey, look what happened to these four. Don't mess around again. So I think there are a lot of, even for the folks who did win, did this send maybe some sort of a warning to them that they're not safe in their seats?
I should amend what I said, that there are a couple of issues that where Speaker Matt Huffman would differ than Speaker Jason Stevens if elected. The two that come to mind are school vouchers. Matt Huffman has been a fierce advocate for expanding school vouchers. It's already been expanded. It might be expanded more. Matt Huffman has also supported getting rid of the income tax, perhaps a little bit more than Jason Stevens has. And then also right to work, which has become an issue not only among Democratic members. This is about whether people in a union shop should be forced to pay union dues as a condition of their employment. And as more unions get involved in Republican primaries, because Republicans are dominant in the state legislature, it's become more and more of an issue. Jason Stevens has not been a supporter of right to work, at least not nearly as vocally as Matt Huffman has.
Yeah, actually, for those who have been following Ohio State House and speaker politics for a long time, Larry Householder cut a deal with Democrats when he became speaker to keep right to work off the table.
It's a big bargaining chip, and it's something that unions have fended off for a long time.
I want to play a clip from Matt Huffman, the man who is probably definitely going to challenge Jason Stevens for speaker next year.
I certainly am committed to making sure, whether it's me or anyone else, that whoever is elected speaker is elected by a majority of the majority caucus, which I think will be, I think the Republicans will hold the House, and I think the speaker should be elected by the majority.
See, that gets to what happened with Stevens, right? Because he had 22 Republicans and 32 Democrats, and that's how he made it over 50. So I find it interesting that Huffman is angling that whoever has the most Republicans should become speaker.
I don't think that talking point is ever going to die down. I think as long as they can, Huffman and anyone who did not vote for Jason Stevens is going to say, well, we need to make sure that the next Speaker of the House really holds the Republican ideologies, really has the support of their caucus. And I mean, to be fair, we have seen, you know, Huffman seems to have much better control over his caucus over in the Senate, whereas obviously in the House, there's this faction. So Stevens can, you know, talk to his members, but he's always going to have pushback, whether that be from Representative Ron Ferguson, Derek Marin, Phil Plummer. I mean, there's a lawsuit against him by members of his own party, and it all stems back to this Republican infighting and working with the Democrats, which, you know, a lot of people say, you know, it used to be a good thing to work bipartisanly, but I guess that's kind of shifted.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the U.S. House, right? Speaker Johnson could be up on the chopping block for passing a budget.
Sure, and part of this is the Republicans are sort of a victim of their own success here. They have 67 of 99 Ohio House seats, which is the most that any party has had since Ohio went to single-member districts in the 1960s. And when you have that many people in the caucus, it gets unwieldy and it almost inevitably breaks into factions because it's hard to get 67 politicians to agree on just about anything. And so you're seeing such a large caucus get break apart perhaps almost naturally into different factions because it's so large.
Well, and then you're seeing the super minority, the Democrats, actually wielding a tiny bit more power than they would because Republicans aren't working in lockstep. You're seeing Democrats, you know, being yielded some small wins.
But then there's the issues that are clearly very Republican that they are going to get through no matter what, and they'll somehow get on the same page about, like the August election and raising the threshold to amend the Constitution. Somehow they got the votes for that, and they were all, for the most part, on the same page for that. So there's conservative issues like that that they won't waver on, and even if it's delayed or even if it takes a while, they'll get on the same page about it and they'll pass it. Like the gender-affirming care veto override or the tobacco veto override. if it's a conservative issue like that that matters a lot to their base, they'll get on the same page and they'll pass it. But for the issues like Senate Bill 83, that's an overhaul of higher education, they don't necessarily have to pass it, and it might not be speaking to their base as much. So they're kind of like, we don't have to. We can push back on this one a little more.
Yeah, I think it's also in terms of if you're going to cut a deal with the Democrats, they have to feel like they're getting something. And I know Senate Bill 83 has been a real point of contention.
Right.
But we'll see. I want to shift to the Ohio Supreme Court. We have three seats, right, up in November, and that could swing the partisan makeup of the court, either give Republicans a supermajority on the court or perhaps allow Democrats to take over. Jeremy, Democrats running for the court spoke to reporters last week and warned of creeping politicization. What do they mean by that?
Part of it is Ohio Supreme Court races have always been political, whether you like it or not, because people running for the court have run in partisan primaries. But up until fairly recently, when in the general election, there have not been party labels next to people's names on the ballot. Now, thanks to the Republican legislature, there are. So before you would have kind of odd outcomes or unforeseeable outcomes where Democrats would win, upsetting much more well-funded and well-known Republican incumbents. But now it's become a little bit more stabilized because people say, oh, it's a Republican versus the Democrat, as opposed to voting for other reasons. And as a result, and add to it too, now you have possibly it's one of the most important elections for the Ohio Supreme Court in a long time because of the issue of abortion. Now that, as Natalie mentioned earlier, there's a new constitutional amendment guaranteeing abortion rights, it's really up to the Ohio Supreme Court to interpret what that means in practice, like what specific laws are allowed or not allowed under that. And so in the next couple of years, you're going to see a lot of abortion cases come before the court. It's a 4-3 Republican majority now, but if the Democrats can win one of those seats, they have a 4-3 majority. However, it seems right now that the Republicans have the early advantage. And it's also interesting because one of the Democratic incumbents on the court, Melody Stewart, is getting challenged by another Republican incumbent because Joe Dieters, who was appointed to the seat, isn't running for his own seat. He's running against Melody Stewart, and then another Republican's running for his seat. Melody Stewart has been pretty publicly salty about that, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, she has this great quote where she said, seeing him every day is a constant reminder of how hard some of us have to work to get where we are and how some of us don't. That's a little, let's say, annoying.
She tweeted, quote, roses are red, violets are blue. I can't believe you're running to unseat me while sitting next to me all year through.
So talk about bad blood at the court. But yeah, I mean, I think you make a really good point that, you know, they're going to try, at least the Democrats are going to try and make this about abortion and about like other issues like redistricting and say, who do you want to sit on the court to decide these issues essentially? Right, Sarah?
Yeah, I think so.
And I think it's an interesting way to run a Supreme Court race, too, because the justices really, they're not supposed to be playing the sport. They're supposed to be refereeing it. And they have precedents that they're supposed to follow and make their decisions based off those. So seeing these races so politicized is really interesting because you would think that they have legal precedents to fall back on. And that's how they should be making their decisions. But I guess for some of the newer issues, there might not be precedent. So they're the ones who are going to set it.
That was Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. Coming up, we're talking about the billions being given to Intel and why Attorney General Dave Yost is being sued. That's when the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides continues.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable where we talk state politics with three State House reporters. Still with us is Sarah Donaldson, State House reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jeremy Pelsner, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. So, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost made a couple of news on a couple of fronts last week. He is being sued, first and foremost, for his repeated rejections on a proposed ballot amendment that would remove immunity from prosecution for police officers in certain situations. Who can catch us up on what's going on here?
So this proposed amendment has been proposed and submitted to the Attorney General's office several times, 5, 6, 7 times maybe at this point. Over and over again, it gets denied. And Dave Yost's job is to approve the language, make sure, you know, it's a single issue, it's clear to the voters, all that good stuff. So really, again, he's not acting based off opinion. I mean, we see he's approved issues like abortion, things like that. So it's not opinion based at all. But he's rejected it time and time again. The group is going to appeal this decision. Obviously, they're taking legal action as well. So it seems unlikely that unless they make serious changes to the language and really take into consideration what Yost is saying in these decisions, that this will end up on the ballot.
Yeah, this is like a little bit of how the sausage gets made. So this is the language that would be on the petition, right? So like when the folks go out and they try to get you to sign their petition to put something before voters, this is the language that you would see. We'll have to if they get so it's like the first step in the process, right, Jeremy?
Right. Instead of just giving you the whole kind of legalese jargony, like what's going to end up in the Constitution, there's a summary that theoretically, in plain English, says, hey, here's what this would do. And they're now going back and forth about the wording of that.
Yeah. And in his latest rejection, Yost basically wrote, hey, I asked you to fix these things. You did not fix these things. Therefore, I'm rejecting it again. And the Ohio Coalition to End Qualified Immunity disagrees. And I think Yost has until end of day today to file a response. So we'll kind of see where it goes from there.
We'll see. And even if they approve it now, they're really running out of time for this to happen. They have till early July to get, you know, if it's approved, about 413, something like that, thousand signatures, hundreds of thousands of signatures valid. They have to collect even more than that because inevitably not all will be valid. So that's not a lot of time to get a whole lot of signatures.
And this has spanned multiple election cycles. I've been watching this group get their petitions rejected since pretty much I started as a reporter in Columbus like a year or two ago. So,
yeah, they've been going around and around for a while. Dave Yost also weighed in on the U.S. Supreme Court case concerning presidential immunity and whether former President Donald Trump should have that immunity. The high U.S. court, is going to hear oral arguments in April. We don't need to spend much time on it. I just wanted to kind of acknowledge that he's also putting his hand into that case. But I did want to talk about intel. So the Biden administration reached an agreement to provide intel with up to $8.5 billion in direct funding and $11 billion in loans for computer chip plants in Arizona, Ohio, New Mexico, and Oregon. So big news. We saw Sherrod Brown was all over this the morning that it came out. This is how important is this money?
This is the big kahuna for Intel. I mean, Intel basically held up the groundbreaking when they were first breaking ground on the plant in Ohio because there was political fight over the CHIPS Act. The state has already disbursed a lot of money to Intel to work on their project in Ohio, but they, you know, continued to say we're waiting to see with CHIPS Act money. So this is the big one for Intel. They've been waiting for this because a lot of their project rests on not just their investment, but that the state is investing in them and the federal government is investing in them to actually get this project in New Albany done.
And this project is poised to create hundreds of jobs in the state to boost the economy. So this project is no small feat for Ohio. And I think the idea of Governor Mike DeWine and his administration is this is the first step to making Ohio, like, quote, you know, the Silicon Valley of the Midwest. So if Intel doesn't ultimately meet their timelines and their deadlines, what does that mean for other companies? What does that mean for people moving in? What does that mean for development of apartment buildings and businesses around Intel?
And I should say the state has, like I said, dispersed the money already. But if Intel doesn't meet its deadlines, the state can claw that money back. And they've already said the project is going to be delayed from what their initial goal was. They said an initial goal of 2025 being online was aggressive. Now they're at like 2027. The state's deadline, I believe, is 2028.
So the argument for this money is that what the Biden administration is saying is that by 2030, that this would put the U.S. in a position to produce 20% of the world's most advanced computer chips. And right now it's zero. And the argument is, well, that's a national security risk because you're relying on foreign nations to produce these chips that the country really needs. But on the other hand, too, this announcement was made in Arizona, where not all this money will go to Ohio. It'll go to New Mexico. It'll go to Oregon. And it'll go to Ohio and Arizona, which, of course, Arizona is one of the big battleground states this year. So it also has a political angle to it, too, because, you know, if you're running for re-election, it doesn't hurt to make announcements like this in a battleground state.
Yeah, I think that's also why we saw a very quick announcement from Senator Sherrod Brown, who negotiated or helped negotiate the CHIPS Act. So he was very quick to be like, see, you see what I did there?
I think something else that's interesting is a lot of state house representatives and senators say, well, it's not really the federal government who brought this to Ohio, it's us. So I think that's interesting.
Well, it's that that cliche, right? Victory has 1,000 mothers while defeat is an orphan.
And it's really bipartisan support, though. Like in Congress, Ohio's most, if not all, of Ohio's congressional delegation voted for the CHIPS Act. And this is actually something that has had bipartisan support in Ohio.
And they've been, I mean, not only supporting it, but like there was a letter written last year with, I think, both Senator Sherrod Brown and J.D. Vance and a bipartisan group of members of the House as well, you know, asking, come on, let's fast track this CHIPS Act money. Like, let's get it out of here. So it's definitely something I think most Ohioans want to see succeed.
So Governor Mike DeWine on Friday signed an executive order to create a new law enforcement accreditation system. So to get accredited, agencies need to meet or exceed 31, quote, gold standard practices. So what's going on here? Can he just fiat this into existence, basically?
He can. It's one of the powers he has as governor. It's interesting to see, though, there's some things he can sign executive orders for, others he can't. But we know, I mean, I think for the past maybe 2 years, probably longer, he's been pretty interested in law enforcement and what best practices are and making sure that they get the proper training and proper support that they need. So I don't think it's entirely shocking that Governor Mike DeWine did take this step. But yeah, executive orders and emergency orders, those all fall under his purview.
And so this program in particular stems from something that former Governor John Kasich signed into action about a decade ago, I want to say maybe a little less than that. And it was a statewide accreditation program that basically dealt with use of force and hiring practices. So those were the two best practices. This one expands it to like 31 best practices. And the interesting part is the state is going to pay for this accreditation because a lot of policing agencies have not been able to pay for what's called CALEA certification. That's a national certification body, and it's really expensive. So a lot of, you might see bigger agencies like Columbus Police, they're CALEA certified, but smaller agencies may not be able to get certified by CALEA. So the argument is we're going to have this state system that accredits on a lot of the things that CALEA accredits on, but we'll cover the costs, which DeWine says no other state has done that.
Yeah, for the past decade, Ohio, like the rest of the country, has had a problem with police shootings dating back to Tamir Rice in Cleveland, John Crawford near Dayton. And the Republicans, especially, their response to this has been, well, let's improve police training. But then the major problem with that is, under Ohio, if you under Ohio's system up until now, if you don't have the funding for it, the training standards don't have to be enforced. And it's really been voluntary for these police departments to do it. But then a lot of police departments, especially smaller police departments, say, well, we don't have the money for this. If we have 8 officers on our force, we can't afford to send 3 of them to London to the statewide police training academy and then cover the room and board and all that. So this has been a years-long effort to provide more funding. There still is no dedicated source of police funding in Ohio. It's really on an ad hoc basis. And DeWine has really called for a permanent source of funding, and this is one kind of side ancillary step to encourage that.
One of the places he's called for it is in the capital budget, right? He would like to construct a training facility and then dedicate funds to allow these smaller agencies to use it.
The other place I've heard of that has gone to the wayside was in the marijuana program. That was a proposal at one point in the recreational marijuana program to create like a permanent, at least bucket of funding for policing. And, you know, as we know, nothing has really happened in the legislature when it comes to recreational marijuana.
Any chance they move something before summer break?
I say low. So by June 7th, applications for permits for dispensaries need to be put out there. I just did a story about this on Friday. Huffman says he spoke with House leadership. That does not include Speaker of the House Jason Stevens, and he is more optimistic that something moves, whereas the Speaker of the House says the rules process is moving, and I quote, swimmingly. So we're going to wait and see how that plays out. So that's going to be at or around probably June 7th when those rules are rolled out. If they're not going to move anything before then, unlikely they move anything before summer break.
And right now the holdup is the House, I would say, because the Senate passed a package back in December.
A bipartisan package.
Yeah, that they haven't. The House just said this is not really the direction we're moving. And, you know, we may want to make some small tweaks, but obviously small tweaks have not happened.
There's just some concessions in that Senate bill that passed, though bipartisanship, that a lot of House members can't get behind, like halving the home grow, THC, things like that, that House members, both Republican and Democrat, say, nope, not going to happen.
Yeah, it's that idea that voters pick those numbers, we should keep those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. I guess we'll also see about whether the governor gets his police training center in the Capitol budget, because they have to move that before summer break, right?
They don't necessarily have to. I mean, they can decide, you know, if they don't want to pass a Capitol budget at all, they really don't have to. That timeline is kind of, they have to do an operating budget, but the Capitol budget, not necessarily 100% needed to be done. But their timeline is to get this done. I mean, the Senate's taking requests until April 8th, I believe. And then once that is, those requests are in, they'll kind of see where they land with the House. Timeline is likely before summer break, but doesn't have to be done.
Although if it doesn't happen now, this is the one time in recent memory that the state is flush with money. And this, so if it's going to pass now to create a dedicated police training center like DeWine is asking for, this is really the time to do it. Lawmakers don't normally pass a lot of appropriations bills because it's spending money and the governor can issue line item vetoes on it. So they like to group all the appropriations things into one or two big bills, usually budgets. So if they don't include this in the capital budget, I don't think it's very likely they'll pass it at all this year.
And it's trying to hit that construction timeline, too, right? That the capital budget could go out before summer. People could take this funds. They could get construction in before the ground freezes, essentially.
So that's why they've kind of made this deadline. And they say that we have to pass this before summer because, like, you know, shovels are already in ground. Construction projects, they're going to have to either stop or put them on hold. And, you know, then it's going to get too late. They just want to get this done and appropriated before construction season, essentially. So whether that includes an emergency clause or not also remains to be seen.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But they are coming back this week, right? They're headed.
I think they come back next week and then they have their next session the week after.
Mm-hmm. Any sense of what might move in the next couple of weeks?
That's a good question.
Well, I guess that's a loaded question.
There's a sense, there's what might move through one chamber.
That's fair.
And then what might move through the other chamber, because as we've talked about earlier, there's, not a lot of not a big collegial atmosphere right now between the House and Senate leadership. And so we'll see what passes one if it passes the other.
Yeah, that's probably pretty fair. And that will do it for this hour. Thanks so much to Jeremy Pelzner, politics reporter. Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com.
Hey, thanks so much.
Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4.
Great to be here.
And Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Always glad to come.
And thanks so much for listening to the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides with Anna Staver. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides.